Okay, make sure you're in fellowship so we can continue to profit from the study at hand. Looking at the aspect of testing, recognizing there is a difference between being tempted and being tested. Being tempted, the solicitation to do evil can be part of the expression of our sin nature, or it can come from without. A combination of both, obviously, in that regards. Examples of temptation we're looking at here is Roman numeral 1, subpoint H, point 1, is Christ being tempted by Satan in the wilderness test of Jesus. And obviously, Satan unleashes all that he can come up with, trying to take advantage of Jesus' humanity, being 40 days without eating, and he's hungry, and obviously would like to have some food. When's this going to be over? You know, they're all waiting for lunch routine, but Jesus obviously is able to field what Satan throws at him. And Satan even uses doctrine which to try to get Jesus to abuse God's will for his life, whereas Jesus obviously is discerning, recognizing the context which the aspect of the fact that the angels would protect Jesus during his ministry, that this was not the occasion for which that application would be a part of. And he deals, obviously, with the proper interpretation and discerning application in regards to what Satan throws at him here in Matthew 4, verses 1 and following. And to take doctrine out of context, abuse of grace, other abuses of doctrine as may be, is on the other end of the coin, testing God rather than being a test otherwise for the individual. As verse 7 and verse 8, continue here to finish this out. Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. The final coup de grace, if you will, that Satan tries in regards to Jesus is, look, you don't have to go to the cross. You don't have to suffer. You can end all this nonsense right now. I'll make you king of the world. I'll exalt you. I'll place you in that power, and you'll be the possessor of all things, obviously, if you'll just acknowledge me in regards to, as he was stated, my rightful position. That's the aspect, the temptation of verse 8, to bypass the cross, to cater to compromise one's suffering in life for the sake of making things easier, bypassing and doing shortcuts, expediency, other aspects regards to reasons why people will compromise doctrine otherwise. In regards to their lives. And verse 9, and he said to him, all these things will I give you if you will fall down and worship me. Third class condition, recognizing Jesus must make this choice. And then Jesus said to him, that one doesn't even deserve a response. Some temptations are truly ludicrous in regards to what's going on And he simply says, "Be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." So the test is over. He's delivered. Satan doesn't have complete reign in regards to Christ. One of the things and aspects regards to the angelic conflict. And as things occur, understand Satan's still in the control of God. He's not omnipotent. There are certain rules, certain things he's got to follow in regards to this strategic warfare that we're in. So remember, God's always in control, and there is ultimately always deliverance in regards to our tests. And the devil left him, and behold, angels came again to minister to him. A little comfort food, chicken fried lamb, whatever, you know, ease his stomach, and got his deserved rest that he needed to have, et cetera, to replenish his physical being. And then you see an application of the angels. The elect angels, while he maintained their integrity, recognizing their proper position before God, now they are able to respond in a like way in regards to his success and respect to the temptation. So you have Jesus being tempted overtly. Obviously, the difference between his temptations, they were all overt. He did not have a sin nature. But obviously, look at his niche, and there's no way he could and been successful otherwise in regards to his ministry and who he was to be as preordained by God, the Messiah of the world. So that's an example of overt temptations. Two examples of temptation within, the pursuit of wealth is one that will and have taken many people down the path of spiritual destruction, forfeiting the prize because of money. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation. You let your ambition go beyond your doctrinal restraints, then you're on this path. You are going beyond temptation when one otherwise then engages that pursuit and a snare and many stupid and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. I know you're saying, well, I just want enough to, you know, have a little of this, have a little of that. Well, hang in there. Maybe you'll get it. Or you can go underneath your flesh and go try to get it yourself. Do what you're going to do. You say, well, that's not very encouraging from a pastor. No, that's just a pastor that's oriented. People are going to do what they're going to do. And you can sit there and exhort until you're blue in the face, and they're still going to go do what they're going to do. James 1:14, but each one is tempted when he is carried away, enticed by his own lust. The picture here is the union of temptation with the sin nature, which is shown as sexual, spiritual infidelity in a sexual way. Then when lust has conceived, your sin nature, obviously lusting after whatever it is in that regards, and then that's dangled in front of you, either through your own thinking or overtly by others and things of that nature. And you give it the green light, the temptation, and to go into union with this bastard offspring of sin. And that's when you go from temptation to sin. Then when lust has conceived, it bears sin. When sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. And that brings about temporal death, which is not arrested by rebound and maintained, eventually can lead to operational death and sin unto death, ultimately. Then, point three, an example of the combination of both overt temptation as well as temptations of within, as it applies to sexual deprivation in marriage. One of the greatest things that an engaged couple should be looking forward to in regards to their marriage is having sex, but you never hear that hardly anymore because they've already been doing it for who knows how long. And when you are married, as partners, you have an obligation to one another sexually to ensure that one is not deprived on either side of the coin. And when that does occur, the cutting off tactic, as it may be in regards to one spouse or another, obviously the natural desires of the experience is still fresh in your mind usually. And one can easily then find themselves being tempted by another partner elsewhere. 1 Corinthians 7:5. The admonition is stop depriving one another. Quit playing this you don't do what I want you to do. You don't get any game. Yeah. On either side of the coin. It's always nice to be on the other side of the coin for once in your life, but for guys often that doesn't probably happen all that often. But either way, yeah. It's still the deprivation can come from the male just as easily. They work all the time. They had no time for their wife. When they're not working, they got to be out pursuing other things in life. So things of this nature. Be preoccupied. And obviously, the female desires the emotional embrace and union in that regard. So, you know, it's not just a one-sided coin. If this was just all on the female side, then why didn't Paul just address it that way? No, stop depriving one another. See, so you got to recognize it can come from either direction. Except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Excuse me, prayer and a cigarette. Thank you. Oh, okay, you don't like that one. The tobacco, I know, turns you off. So anyway. Truly, the expectation is for married spouses to thoroughly enjoy themselves and indulge themselves. You know, simply short of making sure that their spiritual responsibilities are otherwise taken care of in their lives and other responsibilities, obviously. And come together again, see. Your break is not for sex. Your break is for prayer. Then you come together again. See, that's the idea. I had never heard that one taught in the Nazarene church. One position, missionary style. That's it. Yeah. Right. Unless Satan tempts you because of your lack of self-control. Obviously, the lack of self-control looks at the sin nature in its solicitation. In regards to desiring sex, and here you have a legitimate platform of which it should be fulfilled. And Satan's reading all this. He knows what's going on in your household. Don't think he doesn't. He doesn't have to be there personally. He's got his entourage out reconning for his old tactics. Man, look at these people. They're sexually trying to starve each other, you know. Well, let me introduce you to so-and-so. So, doesn't mean that's the way it always happens. Obviously, some STAs, people just have trouble controlling it in that regard. They could be otherwise. You can mess up your own life in regards to diminishing what you have and what God's given you. Another one of those aspects of being acclimated to your life. Always looking for something different. See, that type of mentality. So, you would think to well-rounded, mature people, you wouldn't have to exhort much on that. But the case is, with all doctrine, you constantly got to exhort on it all. Keep it in front of us. Keep it fresh in our minds. See. Can't keep your honeymoon going for 10 years? Well, that's your problem, not mine. Just remember the exhortation. Just remember Paul's exhortation. And all that truly looks at, first and foremost, one's attitude towards one another. So all temptations are part of testing, but all testing is not necessarily temptation. So in testing, you will be tempted, at the very minimum from within, generally speaking. But the test itself is not necessarily the temptation. The temptation is to throw off the yoke of test. God tests believers, but is not the sponsor or author of temptation, recognizing that he is not soliciting otherwise in regards to evil. It's impossible for him to do so. James made that clear for us back in the epistle in James 1:13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. God, in his essence, is immune to evil. Thank God. So, okay, temptation comes from one of three sources. The STA, the world, negative volition, the cosmos, and Satan, which obviously recognizing Satan as the ruler of the world under negative volition. So all testing comes from both God and man. It's just a matter of life, a matter of fact. Example, one of man by God, written out for us here, Genesis 22:1, in regards to Abraham. God tested Abraham. Who God in his foreknowledge destined him to be the forefather of the Hebrew race. And the testing with regards to Isaac, his son. And then 22:12, we'll be doing this verse, time allows us. Do not stretch out your hand against the lad, as Abraham is willing to take the doctrine. And he knows that God promised him an offspring, a seed that would propagate his heritage genetically. And that if he did indeed allow Abraham to kill his son, that he would have to resurrect him to keep this promise going. So this is the kind of doctrine Abraham's applying here. How could you do that to a child? Well, that's just your emotions. If you're still thinking that, then really you haven't come to grips yet in regards to commitment to God. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. If you're still thinking your child comes before God, then you're not worthy of me, as Jesus would say. So, some more of that, you know, I guess, hardcore exhortation and food for thought. Do not stretch out. But Abraham was willing. He knew. And what God was asking to do, one would think, well, that's evil. No, it's not. And obviously the doctrine of the soul was telling him, you know, God's got this all under control. All I got to do is do what He tells me to do, and He'll deliver me. He'll deliver both of us in this regard. Do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God. You can either fear the loss of your child, or you can fear God. That's the idea. Since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And the symbolism is quite clear, as Abraham represents, if you will, the father, and his son Isaac, Jesus Christ, and the willingness to sacrifice. And hence, the father of the nation from which Messiah would come from. Now, don't go out and try to sacrifice your kid over this. God told me to sacrifice him. You may feel like it, but don't. Obviously, God was in direct communication with Abraham on this. Abraham's faith, too, blessing for passing the test. It was deliverance from the test. I didn't have to lay a hand on him. And God provided the sacrifice otherwise, with a ram that was right there, tangled up in the bush, going, crap. I thought I was going to get away with this. No, he wouldn't think of that. But anyway, I don't think rams think that way. Exodus 15:25, in regards to the Exodus generation, the no water, bitter waters test at Marah, and there he tested them. They were constantly being tested. Their problem was they failed their tests over and over and over. So you will be tested by God directly. Obviously, His Word tests us consistently in that respect. So too, then we're tested by one another, man by man. We can test one's intentions, such as Joseph in Genesis 39:7-10. Where he is under in jail, Potiphar, the officer in charge, liked his character. And God is blessing him even in, if you will, these kinds of conditions, and advanced him. Joseph obviously was not the rebellious type that you see in our prisons today when he was in jail. Oriented, acclimated, obviously he was innocent of anything. And you would, even that would be tougher. But anyway, Joseph was a handsome buck, good-looking dude, and Potiphar's wife was a promiscuous type of woman, and she decided she wanted to try to have her way with him. So that's the test that comes before Joseph. People in the cosmos would think, oh, the boss's wife, this is a good way to climb the ladder. You know. But this is not Joseph. It came about after these events, Genesis 39:7, that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. That means she had sexual lust transferring. She said, lie with me. Those words were in there somewhere. But there's a lot of other words probably added to that, and a lot of other type of activity, sensuality, and all the other things that is usually attributed to enticing another person sexually. Don't get caught up, don't get wrapped up in the cosmos and their approach to life and how they act in regard to others and the way they think they got to dress and things of this nature. Don't get caught up in that. That's my exhortation to you, especially as a female. You don't have to look like the cosmos. You don't have to dress like the cosmos. Especially in a sensual and sexual way to attract attention to the eyes of the men. God's got you covered if you're single. In regards to your right opposite number, He's got you covered. Give me a break. You don't have to go out there trolling like you're some lure behind some speedboat looking for the shark. You don't have to. See? Be appropriate. Don't engage in this stuff. Here we're dealing with a married person that's doing that. That's even worse in that degree. She has an obligation, a contract, in regards to the vow she made with her husband, Potiphar. And she's going to break it. Now, if she'd been drunk when she got married, she could have claimed unenforceable law. But anyway, we're not here for law school, are we? But he refused, verse 8. But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here." So she obviously is testing him, tempting him to succumb to her wiles. And he said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge." I've got a great responsibility. I've got an obligation in regards to the authority of this house, first and foremost. First and foremost. The fact that you're married obviously plays a big role in this. "And there is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife." And this guy, this is one of those Gentiles that you go, "Oh, cool. This officer sounds really cool, Potiphar. Very grace-oriented. Someone who did a good job. He was there, and he was a truly pouring, if you will, a spiritual blessing on Joseph. And he gave him the run of the place. Mi casa, su casa. That type attitude, see. Except for one thing. I'm married. It's my wife. Stay away from her. See? "Because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" See? The sin goes beyond just the infidelity with respect to the adulterous act in regard to her husband. But God declares us not to engage in fornication and adultery. See? The sin against God. And often there is no revenge like the scorn of a woman. A woman that's been scorned by a male that she's otherwise thrown herself at. And that's the situation you got here. "And it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day, they did not listen to her, the Lord decided to be with her." That wasn't just a one-time deal. It's like every day he had to get up and go to work and be around this woman. You know, he didn't have cameras, so he couldn't take that home and think about it. Not everybody's awake. But anyway, you know, the thing, take pictures. But anyway. So they test each other. And it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And probably this was more or less prearranged in regards to the whole situation. "And she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me,' and left his garment in her hand and fled," went outside. Flee from Satan, and Satan will flee from you. That's the picture, see. He got the hell out of Dodge quickly. That's the advice that you would get from a person who's looking out for your best interest. I remember one time on my job I had to visit a single lady's apartment to get stuff that she took from work after a fire. And she was fairly attractive. And constantly in contact with our attorney. And walking in the house, look, this is the way the situation is, blah, blah, blah. And I said, she's acting really nice and sweet and everything. He says, get your crap and get the hell out of there. So that's exactly what I did. After I got her phone number. No, I'm just kidding. No. That's you know, one of those things. So she sets it up. And she obviously took matters in her own hand and made false accusation towards him, as the story ends. So that would be fun to do that when we get there. So the wife sought to rouse Joseph's FCA. Joseph sought to rouse the norms and standards for her conscience. Think about it. See. Think about it. Don't you love your husband at all? Neither was successful. And that's the way it is in some cases. Also to test one's faithfulness and grace application and dependability and faithfulness to Bible doctrine. One's faithfulness in grace, 2 Corinthians 8:8. In regards to the Jerusalem offering, the application of giving, first and foremost, Paul makes sure that the Corinthians are clear that the request of application is not incumbent upon them. He doesn't try to coerce them, force them otherwise in regards to the giving. That is free will based on your own application. He said, and that's verse 8, I am not speaking by way of a command, but as demonstrating or proving that the zeal of others, the sincerity or genuineness of your love also, in regards to their application, this is opportunity for application to show positive volition's zeal for other positive volition. It happens to be under a financial test, which Jerusalem got hit pretty hard. Obviously based on who their immediate neighbors were in that regards. Then also 2 Corinthians 8:22 in regards to faithfulness to doctrine. And we have sent with them our brother, whom we have often tested and found diligent in many things, but now even more diligent because of his great confidence in you. And this is regards to Titus. One that's involved in the ministry, you just don't hand them their orders and turn them loose. You obviously test them, and that testing comes through their own fidelity, meeting their own obligations spiritually in regards to their office, etc. Then 1 Kings 10:1, we have there the example of the Queen of Sheba who tested Solomon. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, his wisdom that was bestowed upon him by God in a, even if you will, very supernatural way, she came to test him with difficult questions. So, one's fame, one's recognition of knowing, you can be tested by others. It happens. People around you know that you go to a church that studies the Bible all the time And what would you expect when they would say, well, I got some questions for you? Are you ready to answer? So there you have a doctrinally wise individual being tested by another in regards to their doctrine. And then finally, the area of testing believers should avoid is obviously not to test God. Just as we saw the example of Christ in providing the commandment, another example, Hebrews 3, 8, and 9. In regards to the examples of the Exodus, always provided as a bad example in regards to derelict believers. Do not harden your hearts as when they, the Exodus, provoked me in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years, in spite of all the evidence that God gives in regards to the integrity of His Word and His promises and all these other things. Believers will fail those tests, and in so doing, they test God. Roman numeral 2 simply looks at the vocabulary, primary words in regards to testing, trials, as it may be translated. In the Hebrew, you have the noun 1, nasah, N-A-S-A-H, simply means to test, prove, put to the test, tempted, tried. Obviously, context determines that. 2, bachan, B-A-C-H-A-N, to examine, try, assay, that's critique, examine, test, proved, tried. 3, bochan, B-O-C-H-A-N, same family, testing or test. Then our word 4, tsaroth, T-S-A-R-A-P-H, that means to test, refine, smelt. It's used for refining mind and heart. Psalm 26:2. Examine me, O Lord, and try me. Test my mind and my heart. To open yourself before God. And it's not a challenge, just a recognition of what you expect from God to evidence and reveal for you where you're at spiritually, see, as needed. Then B, in the Greek vocabulary, the verb 1, ekpeirozo, E-K-P-E-I-R-O-Z-O, used 4 times, translated to put to the test or try. The verb to pirazo, P-E-I-R-A-Z-O, used 39 times to make proof of evidence, to tempt, test, tried, examine. 3, the verb dokimazo, D-O-K-I-M-A-Z-O, used 22 times to approve, prove, test, or examine. 4, dokimasia, the noun D-O-K-I-M-A-S-I-A, it's a hapax only used 1 time of testing or proving. 5, dokime, D-O-K-I-M-E, used 7 times, denotes the result of trial, the outcome, hence the evidence proving approval. 4, dokimion, the adjective D-O-K-I-M-I-O-N, used 2 times, the means of proof, the avenue of which one is tested. And then 7, dokimos, D-O-K-I-M-O-S, used 7 times, tested, approved. And then A, adokimos, that's the A is a negative on that, same word dokimos, but the A alpha attached to it, A-D-O-K-I-M-O-S, used 8 times as a negative, not standing the test, rejected, failed the test, the flunky. disqualified, worthless. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light to see these things in Jesus' name. Amen.